place where.
Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 9th, 2017. And colleagues, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5535, Department of Revenue. John Mind, I turn it over to you, and you can share with us what we're going to do today.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, today the department will pick up an item from yesterday to provide additional clarification on the Property Tax Division revenue shortfall. Then there'll be a discussion of liens and collection audits that was requested by the committee. There'll be a discussion of the agency's vacancy report, and then information technology projects and project management. The agency has been responding to subcommittee questions, and those are posted under each day that they've been available. I think the first several days of last week, the agency has posted, the agency has responded to those questions, and they are posted under the specific days. For yesterday's hearing, there are two items of note. One is the agency's research section, which does a fine job, has produced a CAFA revenue forecast, and that's available under yesterday's hearing in that topic, and then also the clarification that LFO talked about. The subcommittee asked several questions about possible legislation, and if it pleases the committee, subcommittee, Mr. Co-Chair, is we would maybe call to the attention the memo that LFO has produced on that subject, but maybe not discuss it today, give the subcommittee a chance to review it. And that those issues that are mentioned in the memo are fall along the lines of the crime of failure to pay taxes, the cyber shaming laws, and allowing an exchange of delinquent tax information between agencies that may be doing contracting. So there's a draft of that memo for the subcommittee to review. And I think that's it from LFO's perspective, Mr. Co-Chair.
Is there another term other than cyber shaming? That's a little rough. All right, that's where we'll keep it for now. All right, welcome. We're glad you're here. The floor is all yours. And so we'll just turn it over to you folks, and you can run with it.
Perfect. Thank you. Co-Chairs Smith, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Waite, and I'm the Administrative Services Division Administrator for the Department of Revenue. And so I had a debrief with Mr. Borden, LFO staff, about my presentation on the property tax governor's budget overview that I provided yesterday. And I would like to provide some clarification because I believe I went into a little bit too much detail about the specifics or technical pieces of certain packages rather than the overall impact. And so I just wanted to give another high-level overview of what the outcome of property tax was in governor's budget. So the total other fund reduction, it was $1.8 million within the governor's budget. This reflects not only the $1 million of empty other fund limitation that we discussed yesterday that is kind of a cleanup piece, but also the actual revenue shortfall for funding positions fully. So we also had a $9,400 general fund reduction. And I want to explain this a little bit because normally if we're asking for general fund, we wouldn't reduce the budget. But because of some of the actions that we had to take in reducing the other fund limitation and the impacts to positions, the position budgeting system required us to take the $9,400 out of general fund in order to balance. So this is really kind of a system glitch issue that the agency didn't have any control over as far as making sure there wasn't a greater general fund impact. So I wanted to explain that a little bit in case you guys saw that we had reduced general fund when we're actually coming back and asking for $431,000 in general fund. So that was what that issue was. And then also, so I wanted to reiterate that there are three positions cut within the governor's budget and 6.35 FTE. So just wanted to reemphasize that.
Can you share us with the committee those three positions? Where are they? What are they? What were the recommendations for those?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, Patrick Heath with the Chief Financial Office. The three positions that were eliminated were appraiser, analyst, three positions. So my understanding is that they're the people who would do the appraisals for centrally assessed and industrial properties.
And do we feel like any of that work is going to be compromised as a result of those reductions?
I have to defer to the department on that.
And I don't want to put you in a bad situation if you need
to. No, so Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, Gary Humphrey, the administrator for property taxes, here, and we can bring him up.
Let's do it just very, very briefly, and then we'll get on schedule.
So Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Gary Humphrey, administrator for the property tax division. And, yeah, short answer would be yes. I talked a little bit yesterday about the impacts of vacancies that we would have in our valuation section. So doing the appraisal work for industrial properties or centrally assessed properties, if we have vacancies there or we've lost positions, then there's just an impact on terms of the, at least the quality of the effort that we're able to put into doing that appraisal work on all those properties. So there's an impact. We would have to get the values on the roll by statute, so we're going to get a value out there, but it may not be the most accurate, may not be the easiest to defend, might lead to more appeals if we don't have accurate values. So there is an impact of not having those positions available.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yep, please, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah.
He just said that there will be an impact not having those positions. So what type of impact and, you know, are you going to be able to function without those positions? I guess that would be the main question. If it's going to have an impact, negative impact, then why are we eliminating the positions?
And I would have to defer that question. Oh, I'm sorry, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, Senator Manning. I would have to defer that question to the administrator, Gary Humphrey, so we can bring him back to the table if you'd like.
Yeah, well, I think that Mr. Humphrey might want to just park for a minute.
So, Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. I haven't quantified the impact. Again, Gary Humphrey, administrator of property tax. We haven't really quantified the impact of that in terms of how much revenue it means to the counties for the property tax system. I think your question is more along how much is that impact? What does that look like? Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. How is that going? And what are the over effect to the agency?
Co-Chair Manning, I think as I was trying to describe there, mostly probably hints to the quality of the effort we're able to put into the appraisal work in terms of we try to go out and do physical appraisals. We're trying to get back out and actually see these properties, do physical appraisals, see what's there, do more complete work. That's an area that gets compromised if we have reductions. So what we do on these industrial returns, we get a return from the taxpayer reporting what their assets are. We're taking that information, updating what we had last year, placing a value. But we're not out there actually physically looking at the property on most of those cases to see situations, see what they have. So there's a lot of value in actually being able to physically be out there, look at properties. That's an area that we wouldn't do as much of. Another area is in appeal support. If we have appeals to some of the values, which I described yesterday, we do get appeals for these. Our ability to defend those versus having to settle those can be compromised a bit in terms of just having to just to get through the work, get it done. Perhaps we're more likely to settle and not be able to adequately defend the property value that we have on there. If you want.
So okay, well, I'm really confused now. We're going to eliminate three positions that have been that provided value to the organization. And when these individuals are unable to be deployed out into the field, and there is an estimated assessment, these estimate assessments have been disputed, and the agency winds up giving money back because we've not had anyone to physically go out there to say that this, in fact, is what's going on, and the agency has no proof. So whatever is based on the estimate, when they appeal it, then the agency kind of rolls over and say, well, here's some of your money back. Is that pretty close?
So just real quick, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, Co-Chair Manning. So these positions were taken specifically because of the shortfall. It would be the agency's preference, of course, not to take the reduction in these positions, but without the revenue stream to support the funding for these positions, that's why we had to take that reduction.
Mr. Co-Chair, one more.
Please.
Okay, so I would be doing a counter argument saying that these are positions that we actually need because if we are not able to provide the necessary resources in order to perform, how does that impact your KPMs as well? I would do a reversal on that and say this is why we need these. You know, even though we're doing this presentation, you need these positions. Your KPMs are reflecting poorly because you the inability to deploy the proper resources that you need in order to reduce present the results, and therefore you're actually giving away money because you can't defend it.
So, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, and Co-Chair Manning, that is absolutely correct, and that is why we were asking for $431,000, a little over that, in general fund that would subsidize these positions. But again, as Mr. Borden has stated, this is a systemic problem, so this happens year after year as the forecast is leveling out. Our personal service expenditures continue to grow because of insurance and other salary increases and so forth. So that's where we're trying to figure out. We know that at this point, 17-19, we need $431,000 to fully fund the three positions. But without some other option, we would have to reduce those positions.
Okay. Okay, I'm assuming that we're going to have to get into a little bit more deep, further discussion about this. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just two questions. Are people already in those positions, or are they unfilled? And how far are you backlogged on appraisals?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer. What I described yesterday was a situation where we were holding around 10 positions vacant, less by any when we didn't have funding. And those positions we filled last summer, and they are all still filled. Now, that doesn't mean that all of our positions in the division are filled. We do have some vacancies still in the position in this particular section. We had two vacancies. I think it's two vacancies we've had realized just in the last couple of months from people that have left for other positions. So we do have a couple of positions vacant there now. But we had filled what we had available to fill last summer after we got the funding for those positions. As far as a backlog on the work that we have or the appraisal work, we're in the season now for both industrial returns and on central assessment, and it's close. I was hearing a report today in terms of we'll get the work done, but there's an impact of not having those resources available in terms of how effective we're going to be and making sure that we're able to get all that work done. We have a statutory date that we have to get values out to taxpayers. We have to get values to the counties. We'll meet those. So it really gets back to some of the quality of that work. So we're doing pretty good in terms of positions we have right now, but we do have a couple of vacancies in that area.
Yes, I understand.
while they're talking. Does that mean if you don't get funding, somebody will be laid off?
Coach Manning, Senator DeBoer. That is possible, yes. We do have some other vacant positions within the division that are the appraiser level in our other section. So if we were to take reductions, depending on the number of reductions, we may be able to absorb that with some vacant positions. We may not. We may be forced into a layoff situation.
Okay. We'll talk more about it later on. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and you had asked some questions at the end of yesterday's hearing about our collections processes and some follow-up on our Secretary of State audit from 2015. So first, Mr. Borden had asked me to talk again about our lien process and when we record liens and people who are on payment plans. So as soon as a debt becomes assessed, we issue what is called a distraint warrant, but we do not necessarily record it as soon as it becomes assessed. We allow taxpayers' appeal rights to expire, so those do get recorded about 90 days later in total. Those are recorded even if a taxpayer is in a payment plan. We tell them that may happen to them if they don't pay it in full. So we're trying to secure the state's interest by recording those as promptly as possible. I think you've probably heard Representative Smith say many times, first in time, first in line. So as soon as we can get those recorded, that protects the interest of the state because we will be first in line if they do sell that house that they are in. We also had some questions about the public notification of delinquent debtors. That's another way, perhaps, of saying cyber shame or internet shaming. Some people call it that in some states. I'm working with Senator Johnson. It's a fairly complex question that she asked yesterday, so I'm working with her and Representative Gomberg on potentially getting some information on that one. The final question that you had was related to our audit follow-up from the 2015, and that was from Representative Gomberg's question about the Secretary of State audit out of September of 2015. And so this spring, they actually, we did our follow-up form with them related to the work that the recommendations in the audit that were mostly about our other agency accounts program. So that is what I handed out to you, and I will get that so it's available online. It's just short notice. So I believe we sent this to the Secretary of State in early March. So the first recommendation was to improve other agency account collections by identifying optimal caseloads for efficient and effective debt collection and pursuing additional staff if necessary. So we had a number under our old system, and with rollout 3, we just started a new system. So we're learning how to actually move through that system and determine what an optimal caseload is. So that one is still in progress. We're learning as much as we can about the processes in the new system and hope to have that stabilized by the end of this year so we can make some good estimates about what is an appropriate workload in the new system. That was the first one. The second recommendation was to improve other agency account collections by asking the legislature to allow other agency account collectors to have access to state tax return information, not federal tax return information, but state tax return information. And in Senate Bill 89 has that language in it. We're asking for it. So if that comes down here, then that would be a fix. So we have marked that as in progress. We have asked for it, and hopefully that will come to fruition. Another recommendation was to improve other agency account collections by improving data sharing with our client agencies. So that we have not yet started that one, but that is on our list of things to do. And we are it's definitely something we're interested in, making sure that we can share information effectively. The next recommendation was to improve other agency account collections by boosting outreach to increase full collections assignment and tax refund offset assignment. And we've marked that one as fully implemented. DAS has restarted their statewide accounts receivable management group. And one of the purposes of that group is to engage state agencies to make sure that they're aware of our collection function as a tool for them. So we meet with them regularly. State agencies have the opportunity to send the debt to us, and this is just an ongoing something that we plan to continue to do into the future. We just find a lot of value in talking to our partner agencies and making sure they understand the tools that are available to us, to them, excuse me. The next audit recommendation was to improve other agency account collections by streamlining service agreements and working with our clients, our client agencies, to allow expanded access to garnishments. So we have streamlined those service agreements into four different templates, which had been originally customized to each client. So we had quite a few of them. So now they're streamlined into four. And we worked with many of the agencies to allow us to garnish the debtor. Some agencies are prohibited by federal law to garnish the debtor, and some just don't allow us to do that at all, even though they know that it's available for them. So for the remainder of the agencies in our response, it's just the value of the dollar was too small to be worth a garnishment tool use.
Let me ask a question. You said that there are some cases where the state cannot garnish an account in order to get the state's money. Who would that be?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, I believe that there are accounts, types of income that are protected from garnishment, benefit overpayments, federal. The agencies can reduce a benefit payment to repay an overpayment, but we can't garnish the benefit. It's protected income. I can get an exact answer for which agencies are. I think there are some agencies that by policy do, but I'm not sure which ones those are. But the ones that are prohibited by federal law are usually situations where there's like some sort of a benefit that's being paid, like whether it's SNAP or unemployment benefits, that kind of thing. They can reduce future benefits, but they cannot garnish those benefits, so we can't do that.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Okay. The next recommendation was to improve other agency account collections by working with agencies to have original debt due dates included in accounts assigned to OAA. And that's in progress. With our third rollout, we did have a field created so agencies can send us that date. Our client agencies are working to be able to send us the date, but we can receive it if they send it to us now. So that's why it's still marked as an ongoing initiative. And then the final one in the audit report was prioritize automated matching of debtor data for both other agency accounts and tax units to wage and other databases to improve collection effectiveness. So this is a twofold part. Our other agency accounts department has rolled out what they call debt scoring. That has fully been implemented, but we're still working on doing that for our tax debt, for personal income tax and other tax programs. So that is still in progress. As far as some of the other recommendations that were in the audit report that weren't necessarily in the actual recommendations, they talked about other states using financial institution data match. They talked about, I think, public notification of delinquent debtors as tools, and those are all things that we're exploring. There's employer new hire reporting is actually, both of those are in bills that are down here in Ways and Means, Senate Bill 254. That Senator Taylor has championed for us. We very much appreciate her and in fact Senator Johnson's help on that. So those are all things that we have been working toward and would continue to ask for your support in those tools that we're requesting as part of, that were in the Secretary of State audit report as well.
Okay. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Mack. First of all, I wanted to back up to the question of liens, and you and I have talked a little bit offline, but could you, just for the purpose of our record here, remind the committee the relationship between the lien process and credit reports?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, liens show up when we record them in county records. They show up in the judgment section of a person's credit report. They usually drop a credit score by about 30 points and can have a pretty significant impact. They may affect student loan financing. They may affect ability to get housing. So they're pretty substantial impact on a taxpayer's record.
And just to be clear, Mr. Chairman, if I simply don't pay my taxes and no lien has been filed against me, that does not show up in my credit report. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, that is correct. We have worked with the collection agencies, and because they report both good and bad information, there's a number of reasons why they don't accept tax debt from the department, from the state agencies, the state taxing authorities. One of them, and I'm going from memory, we have a memo that we prepared for Representative Gomberg some years ago. There needs to be uniformity amongst the states for them to take the debt. Two, we would have to report the debt on they report good behavior and bad behavior. So, you know, the R1 paid as agreed, there is no such thing for tax debt. So it's kind of like the analogy I said, it's kind of like putting a square peg into a round hole. It doesn't quite fit the installment debt component of reporting. So there's a number of other reasons as well. The double reporting, because we do report it into the county lien record, it shows up as a judgment, may also show up if we reported it up top. On the top of the credit report. So those are reasons why we do have authority to do that, but the credit reporting agencies don't accept tax debt, and it's not unique to Oregon. It's other states as well.
So, good. Mr. Chairman, a different question, Ms. Mack. You talked about some of the broader suggestions that were made in the audits, and you touched on data match. You touched on public notification of debt. The third one that the audits really zeroed in on that you did not touch on is the question of vendors. And we've talked about that a little bit here, that according to the audit, there are as many as 9,000 businesses that the state is hiring for different kind of work that owe money to other agencies. That's the one that makes me absolutely barking crazy. I think I've used that phrase more than once here. What are we doing about finding people that owe us money that we're also paying money to?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, that is something that we have been working with DAS and ODOT for the last year on, trying to figure out how to share that data. Many of the accounting systems are, some agencies are in the state financial management system, SFMA, SFMS, and some of them are not. And so the interface. So the data, we have to get some standardized data to streamline this process. What we found, there's some due process constraints, and DAS is actually working on a report related to this vendor offset pilot project that we studied. There's some due process constraints. We can't just take someone's money without giving them an appeal, right? So one of the things we looked at without having to have any legislation is the ability for the agencies to put the payments on an administrative hold while we issue a garnishment to the agency if there's a debt. So that is something we're very close to being finished with a review of. Our procurement staff in Sean's shop and in our statewide procurement office, they have been working on ways to look at the debt up front to see if they have debt before they enter into a contract with them. Sometimes these vendors are what are called sole source vendors. There's no other place for the state to get the item that we're asking for. So we need to manage that contract in a different way, including having a payment plan a requirement for that contract and to withhold some of that up front. I know DAS is also looking at modifying contract language to make sure that it's very clear up front that vendors that will take our payments first and remit net to them, so that it's something that going forward, hopefully we'll have a more compliant pool of vendors in the future. But that is definitely something we're working on, and we've been working on it. I think it was actually a result of Senator Johnson's request out of the Transportation Committee last year, and that's why we started working with ODOT and the Connect Oregon project and going forward. But we're very close to being finished with that analysis.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I may, just one more question here. So I looked over your audit follow-up form that you've just provided to us, and I appreciate that. I want to say that sincerely. The Secretary of State's audit made a number of specific recommendations to your agency, and while the director at that time, Mr. Buchholz, responded in general terms, you've responded in more specific terms. I appreciate that. that's the narrow focus. I'm trying to get to the bigger picture here, because that audit, as you suggested at the top of the form you gave us here, is titled Oregon Needs Stronger Leadership, Sustained Focus to Improve Delinquent Debt Collection. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about some five or six specific things within the Department of Revenue, but the audit itself talks about the need for leadership, mm-hmm. the fact that we're too decentralized, the fact that agencies aren't talking to each other. Help us understand the big picture here and what we can do as a committee here, whether it's with your agency or we also oversee the DAS budget and can have these difficult conversations with them as well. I'm not asking you to point the finger at DAS. I'm saying, big picture-wise, how do we get more focus on this problem? How do we get more leadership? How do we get more attention to the big picture, not just the five or six specific suggestions made to the Department of Revenue?
And Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, that is something that we started work on last session after this report came out through Senate Bill 55. And so it created two positions within DAS that have since been filled that provide that oversight. So there had been a period of time from probably 2010, 2011, where there hadn't been that oversight. We had a statewide accounts receivable management committee, they call it SWARM, and they reinstated that as soon as they hired Gerald Floyd back into the position that he had been in prior. So he is coordinating that through DAS. He's very diligent about making sure that the agencies know the tools that are available to them and providing that oversight through rulemaking, standard vendor processes, all of that. He's very involved in that. And that is at DAS, and that came out of Senate Bill 55 as a direct result of this audit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Mack. Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
That's all I have if you have any other questions.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, you got here just in time.
I came late to the party here. Okay. So share with me where do we want to go next?
Vacancies.
Vacancies? Yeah. Oh, okay. Vacant position report?
Yes.
Is that where we are? Okay. I apologize, colleagues. I was out in the hall there. Welcome.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Chris Kautz. I'm the deputy director at the Oregon Department of Revenue. Pleasure to be here this afternoon. So first, what I want to do is answer Representative Gomberg's question directly. He has indicated concern about the fact that the figure he was indicating was about $10 million in personal services savings due to the vacancies. We have gone back and taken a look at the information that we have internally through April of 2017, the end of last month. Those total personal services savings due to the vacancies we have in our organization are $9.1 million. As you heard Sean say the other day, we have committed to reverting at a minimum $4.5 million of general fund back at the end of the biennium that we do not plan to use. About $4.5 million was also used for double fills this current biennium. So that is where that money has either been saved and or used in that process. So I wanted to make sure that we addressed that specific question first and foremost as we move forward. We were planning to have more of a vacancy conversation on Thursday this week, and so I do not have a prepared presentation for you to talk in detail about vacancies today. I am prepared to do that on Thursday as we go through that process. If you can wait, that would be my preference, but if you want to, I'm happy to try to answer questions as I sit here today.
You okay with that?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, but we do have a vacancy summary on OLIS right now. I think we do have that.
Okay.
Yes.
Yep. So we have that. So, colleagues, we can review that on our own, and then on Thursday we'll be ready to go.
You bet. Sounds like a plan. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Perfect. All right. So in that case, then we're going to move to...
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yes, Representative.
From my own background and for the benefit of members that are either new to this committee or new to the legislative process, can you just give us a quick, simple review? What is a double fill?
Sure. Co-chairs of the committee, Representative Gomberg. So, as you know, you give a specific position authority, which generally is one position, one FTE, which in most cases means one individual that gets hired into that position. A double fill is that you use that position authority to hire two people. So you have put two people on one position. That's what we call a double fill. We have talked about in here in committee where we have used double fills. We have 30 positions that are currently assigned to our core system replacement project, and we have double filled behind those. We have positions in our tax services unit, as an example, that we have double filled during this tax processing season to try to provide better customer service on the phones. So those are areas and issues where you will see us using double fills, taking one position and filling it with two people.
If I may. So, yeah, please, John.
Mr. Kutcher, pardon me, and members of the subcommittee, the important thing about double fills is that there has to be another source of funding available for them.
Right. And we have used personal services funding and vacancy savings, in other words, to do that. And we have done that because, for example, I don't know the exact numbers, but I can use an example. In tax services, we have 10 positions of people answering the phones during a tax processing season. But we know that that means long wait times for our customers. Mm-hmm. So we have chosen to double fill 5 of those positions. This is an example. This is how it works. We've chosen to double fill 5 of those positions. So now the wait times can be lowered as people call in, because there's now 15 people to do the work that was originally identified as 10. We're right now, and I know that the other administrators have talked about this, in the process of trying to rebalance and redistribute our business processes. And so what that has required us to shift some resources around to address the ebbs and flows of the changes in business processes that have mainly come around our core system replacement project.
So share with us, and we can advance this conversation or further this conversation on Thursday, and if you want to wait till then, that's fine. But share with us, why not report back to Ways and Means during interim days or at other times about those activities? Why not just keep us in the loop on that?
Co-chairs, members of the committee. So in some cases, there is an awareness that we would double fill up front. That has been the understanding, as an example, all along with the core system replacement project. For other areas, though, sometimes it is timing, between when committees are available and when we do the hiring. Most of the time it is because it's a management decision about resources and where they're needed. And to be frank, Co-Chair Smith, we don't know yet what the right distribution of our positions is, because we're still in that stabilization period. I really believe that over the course of the next year or so, we'll have a much better picture of how to distribute that workload and come back to you to say, we think here are places where things need to shift around, where you've given us resources here, but that isn't the highest and best use for them because the business processes has changed, and here are where the resources are needed now. An example of that that's very clear and specific is third-party filing enforcement. We have found that for the most part, that work has been automated through our core systems replacement project. But what we have also found is that in our fraud and suspense area, that work has gone up as a result of the new fraud manager and the systems that we have in place. Because those classifications are the same for the positions that we're doing filing enforcement and fraud and suspense work, we have shifted that workload in order to, one, we've made a commitment to our staff via the core system replacement project that nobody would lose their job at revenue, but their job may be different at revenue as a result of the project.
So, and again, to me, that's logical. I get that. But at what point do you report back to John and LFO telling us that occurred?
So
how does that work?
Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, we haven't traditionally done that, to be frank. because we have managed within the appropriations that you have directed us. So the work that I talk about in filing enforcement that has moved to fraud and suspense, that's all within the personal tax and compliance division of which you've given us an appropriation for. So we are within the appropriation, but we are shifting our resources to manage the workload.
And if I could follow up, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, another avenue that we have, and we have been talking about it at a leadership level, is that as we're realizing how positions are or the workload is shifting because of the system and the functionality, that as we're kind of shaking out the next year, that we will be presenting probably permanent finance plans that do go through the LFO office. And then if we also address some of the funding needs of those permanent finance plans, we would definitely be coming to the committee with an update.
I think you folks are, and all agency directors are in agencies are in a unique situation. You have to be flexible. I get that. You need to put your resources where they need to be. I just think agencies, and I'll use you folks as an example, would avoid a whole lot of headache if you just come forward and say, you know what, we recognized after session adjourned, we needed these seven positions moved over here, this is what we did. I think you'd find us go, oh, okay. But instead what ends up happening is we uncover it, we discover it, we're told it by somebody who thinks they're a whistleblower, and the next thing you know, people speculate. And then they speculate to the negative, which is human nature, and it causes a whole lot of headache that really didn't need to be if someone would just come forward and say, we needed to move these 7 or 10 positions. I'm just being candid with you.
I think the challenge is, I don't have a problem reporting it. I think it is about the question of management doing day-to-day operations and just making those decisions and moving forward to get the resources.
And I don't lose sleep over this.
No, I appreciate that.
I promise you, but but we are accountable to voters. And when folks on the street or in the hall ask us, why is Department of Revenue double filling these positions and we can't answer it, it makes it awkward for us. And then we speculate to the negative, and then
I understand.
We end up in awkward situations. And I just think you do yourself a huge favor by having a closer working relationship with LFO staff and reporting these things. All right.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to get in, I understand, into the specifics a little later, so I'm just still working at a general term. I wanted to ask about vacancies. Uh-huh. If we have these vacancies, are they voluntary vacancies, or are we making a management decision to vacate some positions when we choose to double fill someplace else?
Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, they're all, but for any disciplinary action, they are all voluntary. So they have left for another position in another organization, whether private or public sector. They've retired, those types of things. There has been no layoff in our organization at this point in time, or a reduction in force.
And one more clarification, Mr. Chairman. The double fill positions, are they permanent? Are they limited duration? Are they temporary? What is the classification of those appointments?
Co-chairs and Representative Gomberg, it can depend. We have done a filling of double fills with permanent people. We have done them with limited duration. We have done them with seasonals. So it depends on the work and the workflow need.
John?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, just to be clear, double fills are off budget. So they're not a budgeted position. Only the legislature can authorize positions and full-time equivalents. So when we talk about double fills, it's not like we can see them budgetarily through the system. We have to go through an additional step, like the agency has done here, to specifically identify them. All we can see is what has been authorized by the legislature. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
All right. So let's hold the remaining of our conversation on vacant positions until Thursday, and let's move now to information technology projects and project management. Welcome.
Thank you.
You could just introduce yourself.
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Johnson. I'm the Chief Information Officer for our Department of Revenue. I welcome this opportunity to come before you and give you the detail you're looking for on our modernization efforts at the department. As you may recall, I was here in March testifying on some of these initiatives. At that time, I mentioned how our many of our systems are having trouble keeping pace with some of the changing business needs and legislative requirements and becoming quickly obsolete. That has not changed in the month and a half that we've been away. Those legacy systems not only pose a critical threat to revenues business continuity, but they carry with them a very large maintenance and operational burden. In addition to really exposing us to some opportunity costs. While all these projects are driven by the desire to mitigate some of the risks I just mentioned, what I failed to mention when I was here in March, and I think my colleagues did a very good job of doing over the last week, is talking about some of the business benefits we're seeing. We're seeing some real indicators that we're going to get some tangible business benefits out of our systems, whether it be through improved automation, process improvement, and just general adherence to tax administration best practices. So that's the impetus for all of what we're doing here with these modernization efforts. We're really trying to be able to sustain our revenue generation for the state, on behalf of the state, and being more reactive more quickly to ever-changing environments, whether they be political, economic, business-related, et cetera. So, I think it's essential that we continue to support these initiatives for that purpose alone. My intent here today is to share some timelines, milestones, and some risks specific to the particular projects we're working on, assumptions, benefits, et cetera. If I'm not hitting the right level, I have complete trust that this committee will redirect me in the appropriate way. So with that, we'll get underway. And first thing we're going to talk about is our core system replacement project, otherwise known as CSR. I think you'll all remember that this is our largest project at the moment. It's a multi-year, multi-phase project. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because it's my understanding that many of these committee members have a pretty solid understanding of what's going on here at this point in time. Outside of just saying that we're on budget, we're on schedule at this point in time without any customization, and we're working towards a seamless transition to operations. Any additional questions on that? Okay. So maintenance and support is something that we've been working on with our LFO staff here. It is something that's identified at a tier two level in a governor's budget. And at this point, we're talking about a possibility of augmentation to tier three. And specifically what the difference is between Tier 2 and Tier 3. Some of the risks associated with not having Tier 3. The essential component between Tier 2 and Tier 3 really comes down to fast resources. With Tier 2, we only have fast resources on site in the event that something breaks and is deficient on as a result of some of their programmatic changes. It doesn't allow for the knowledge to continue to apply service packs, upgrades, et cetera. The other thing that I might just throw out there as a reminder to this committee is that we currently have a significant number of DOR staff focused on the implementation of this project. And we have roughly 30 fast contractors on site with the implementation. After the implementation with Tier 2 support, the vast majority of those FTE go away, and we're left to our own devices to work through this system. We have been doing knowledge transfer through the entirety of this implementation. But the skills required for production support versus implementation are vastly different. So there haven't been a lot of opportunities for the DOR staff to really transition to an operational support capacity at this point, at this juncture. With the augmentation of Tier 3 support, we'll be able to assure ourselves that we can maintain the system at the minimum level we need to maintain it at. In addition, we'll be able to cross-train some of the revenue staff to make sure they can support it in the future, because that's ultimately our goal, is to maintain the system with internal resources.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative.
So is that what I'm looking up there? Is that the difference between the Tier 2 and the Tier 3? So you pay extra $2.4 million for Tier 3 support?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nierman, that is correct.
So is that an annual number or a biennial number?
That is an annual number.
So you have your own IT shop, though, right?
That's correct.
This core system replacement, it's a C#.NET with a Microsoft SQL Server behind it, right?
Co-chairs, Representative Nierman, that's correct.
Good. So if I double that number and make it a biennial number, so for $4.8 million, I should think that your own IT shop should be able to support that for much less than that, don't you think?
Co-chairs, Representative Nierman, I think at some point that's completely feasible. I think to equate it to just the back-end technology in terms of what the support requirements are is a little overstated. I think there's a lot more complexity involved with this system than simple back-end Microsoft technology.
I get that. Nobody ever went broke underestimating the complexity of software projects. So I'll stand chastened, duly chastened on that. But $4.8 million, that seems like a pretty big ticket. If I was you, I'd double the size of my IT shop and say, I'll take that on myself, and I'll do it for $3 million a biennium or something. That seems like that's a doable thing to do.
Co-chairs,
let me ask a question following up on that. Yeah. It'll all play together. Share with this committee why you chose to show an annual number when we deal in biannual budgets.
That's a fair question. So we did actually receive. It was identified in, I believe, POP 104. That got approved or picked up CSR, remaining CSR stuff. No. So we did get funding in governor's recommended budget for the remainder of the project. I don't recall which POP that was at this point in time. There was an additional POP 102 that split because the project ends in the middle of the biennium. We only have a year left of non-funded support for the CSR program. So that's why we're showing a year in this particular
slide. You only need a year of support.
Correct.
Thank you. That seems reasonable.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm not understanding then. So this isn't an ongoing biennial figure that'll go on for the life cycle of the project. This is just 1 year of extra kind of hitting the ground support.
Co-chairs, Representative Nierman, that is correct. That's not to say that we wouldn't be coming back next biennium and asking for additional support. So what we've learned as we've gone out and heard from our other Gentac states is that it typically takes about 5 years for the knowledge to fully transition in an operational capacity, remind you, not implementation capacity, for staff to feel confident and agile enough to support the system. The other thing that we're looking at this point is simple just numbers. As Deputy Director Couch just mentioned in the FTE counts, we've got these people on a TWA. They go back to their business at the end of this. So we're going to be short-staffed in IT as well. So it's not, we got to maintain, keep the lights on for the other systems that we talked about. We also have to continue to support some of those legacy environments that I've trying to ring the alarm bell about. We also need to maintain this huge system, which requires a lot of care and feeding. Thus the ask.
Good, thanks.
So share with us, if this is going to be for 1 year, how many IT vacancies will we have after that?
Co-Chair Smith, we have currently, I believe, 3 FTEs that are vacant in our organization.
And those positions are?
Reflected in there? No.
Okay, help me. So, I apologize. We need to step back to 100 level.
Fair enough. So, Co-Chair Smith, these numbers are for the contractor only?
For the contractor.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
So as I mentioned, we've got different skill sets that are needed for implementation versus during the project, or excuse me, post-implementation. We do hope that we can function on our own at some point in the future. We'd love to be able to learn that from someone that can knowledge transfer from us, and rather than baptism by fire. We want to make sure that we're not back here in a couple years asking for more funding for yet another major project, because now this is considered a legacy environment, even if we're moving up to the next version of Gentax. So we need to sustain the current environment. We need to be able to respond to your legislative requirements and the business needs and at all. Any additional questions on that?
I think we're good.
All right. So the next effort we're working on is our processing center modernization. I think if you recall from when I presented back in March, in 2016, we received over 630,000 paper returns. We received over 1.7 million paper payments in 2016, which equated to $3.17 billion, yeah, with a B. Need to be clear on that one. So this system is really critical to the way we do business at the department. This system will fail without some kind of action in the future. The result of that is really that we're looking at manually keying in tax returns, which could delay some of our turnaround times up to a year as a result of not having our front-end systems available to us.
Mr. Coach.
Yeah.
Just a question. You say manually keying in. My experience when I file my taxes is that there's a payment form that has a barcode on it. So is that what you mean by manually keying in, or do you have a scanner that automatically takes care of that information?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, that we do have a variety of ways that we can get information into our system today. The barcode piece, I believe, is referred to as 2D. We do have electronic file as well. But we do still get quite a bit of returns that come through that are just paper returns, where you pick up a paper and you fill out the numbers, and we have to manually key those in.
Could those forms, when you send those forms, could those forms already be barcoded, where the individual, it's already have the barcode on there, and the individual fills it out and stuff, and it just takes the information like that? Could that help expedite this?
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, absolutely, but we can't. The department cannot force people to use the technology that produces the 2D barcodes.
But if that's the only type of form that you're producing, then they have no choice but to use that.
Co-Chair Manning. So the form actually designates that 2D, it's my understanding, and I'm not an expert in this area, and be happy to call someone up if you need more detail on that.
You're the chief I've got them right information officer, aren't you?
I am, but I do not do processing center, unfortunately. So,
okay.
We got more smarter people in the back here that could probably provide that detail. But it's my understanding that 2D is developed based on the information you provide. And so with that, I will defer to Chris Witowski, who is our processing center section manager. And I'll let him introduce himself.
Hi. Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. I'm Chris Witowski, the section manager for a processing center. And your question about 2D barcodes, we receive two different types of paper returns. One of them is the one that you described that has that barcode on it. That barcode and all of the information on those returns is generated by software, usually some sort of tax preparation software that a taxpayer can purchase, generally speaking, and print off those returns and send them to the department. We do have scanners that can read those barcodes and upload that information very quickly. The other type of paper return we get is one that is really manually filled out, either typed or handwritten, and those we do have to manually key. And I believe that's what Mr. Johnson was referring to. If we are unable to get this front-end system through this project we're describing, we will then have to manually key potentially the 2D barcode returns that we receive as well.
Okay, so just real quick, I have on my phone, I have this technology that if I just take a picture of it with my camera, all of the information is uploaded. It's good to go. It takes just like that, it's done. So, and these are just like with business cards.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that the technology just to do that, just to kind of just, instead of someone keying it in, if you had the technology that can just scan the paper, just like you would do a barcode, only you scan it in a document, feeding it through just like that, and it's uploading quick, you don't have that technology, or that's not practical.
Co-Chair Manning, that is exactly why we need to modernize, so we can keep pace with expectations of taxpayers and the technology available.
Wow, I'm surprised that you're not there yet. You know, everybody has. I got it on my smartphone and stuff. You know, you guys collect all the money. Okay.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, if I remember correctly, last summer there was an attempt to get this off the ground, and something didn't quite work out correctly, and we had to pull back in. Give us a little more history on this, because I can't remember it correctly, and for some of the folks here, it's completely new to them.
Sure. Co-Chair Smith, the department did attempt to modernize this area. It was actually a couple years ago. We had a variety of circumstances that we were unable to mitigate. And as a result, instead of chasing a sunk cost fallacy, we decided to start over again, apply the lessons learned on our postmortem, and proceed forward. One of the major differences now is we've got stronger governance. We're working through not only governance within the department, but we're also working with the Office of the State CIO. We're going through their stage gate process. We've got better project management with institutional knowledge, which I would argue is a key contributor to maybe not being as successful as we could.
And so what is that new work going to cost us? Do we have a slide that's going to show us that?
So we have some estimates up there, and I do have to...
Is that what those numbers are?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're on your slide deck. But I will say they're based off of an RFI, not an RFP. They're rough numbers at this point.
I apologize. My computer's dead, so I'm having to go off the screen here.
Coach Smith, fair enough.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
So Based on the timeline you see up there, you can see we're looking at several years out before we actually can complete this effort at this point. We're looking at about 2021 to get fully rolling ahead with all program areas.
So let me ask this question. At what stages in this process are you checking in with John and LFO to give him updates? That's fine.
Coach Smith, I'm going to defer to Ms. Waite as she is the principal contact with Mr. Borden.
So I am the executive sponsor for the governance committee over this project, and we have been going through the stage gate process. I have been providing Mr. Borden with updates as far as not only what we did to terminate the contract that we had initially, but also where we're at as far as what our anticipated costs are going forward, information about where we're at. I've provided the business case for him and all the supporting documentation. I've let him know when we've passed, we passed stage gate one. We are going through stage gate two. We have not heard if we've passed that yet.
And the reason I asked that question is he's the professional we rely on to pass information on to us. The co-chair and I have expressed interest in making sure we're getting updates, and so we just want to make sure that's getting fed to us.
Yeah, and Co-Chair Smith, if I could just follow up, on my side, the IT side, I work very closely with the IT LFO analysts.
Okay.
In this particular case, Mr. McSpaden.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Any questions?
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair, I just want to say that, that you know, I'm seeing movement, which is a good thing. I think that, well, I'll wait till we finish up with everything, but I'm seeing movement. I like that.
Okay. Okay, so we've got about 20 minutes.
I'll
make sure you
quick.
Have ample time. Okay.
Thank you. So our next initiative is not a project. It's a program, the difference being that a program is a lot of little projects under one umbrella of a program. So we have a initiative to get rid of some of the applications that aren't being absorbed by Gentax. Today we have roughly about 30 legacy applications, if you will, that are in scope for us to convert to a new modern platform architecture. It's the .NET environment. If we're able to successfully move forward with some of the other projects I'm talking about, PVS being one of them, the PCM project that I just spoke about, we're going to be able to reduce that number from 30 to about 20, because we'll get the modernization efforts in those other areas will scope some of these other applications that are currently targeted for this program. I talked about this in some detail when I testified back in March, but essentially, you know, we're dealing with technology that is you can't find skill sets for anymore, and we have a retiring workforce. And there is a real urgent need to get these moved over to a supportable, sustainable platform sooner rather than later.
Really quick before you move on, committee, do you realize the issue on this of how outdated the software and the system is, and you're having trouble finding professionals who actually have an education or skill set in that old software?
Correct, yeah. Smith.
Yeah. It's not just an app.
Right. It's just not right.
Well said. Okay. That brings us to our last project, and a significant one as well. So I think you all remember that the property valuation system is the plan is to replace a bunch of disparate older technologies that are not necessarily designed for their use today. There's a desire to and this is for the centrally assessed and industrialized properties. They're looking at finding a COT solution, a CAMA a CAMA technology, which is computerized assisted mass appraisal. This does not directly impact general fund, but it does bring revenues into government streams. As I think everybody knows, Oregon's got jurisdiction over some of these areas, mm-hmm. But we do that basically on behalf of the counties. So jurisdictions that we do this for would be better served and could create a better revenue stream for them as a whole.
So how accurate is this? I see vendor selection occurring next month.
Co-Chair Smith, I think that is still the plan. I think actually the hope was that we were going to be able to get it done earlier than that, but as a result of some legal sufficiency around the RFP, that's been pushed out a little bit.
But you feel like that's on schedule there?
It's my understanding that that's on schedule.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
I think the big thing with this is really today, and Mr. Humphrey was talking about some of our challenges with being accurate and consistent, the iron triangle of project management is no different for his business with regard to the consistency, getting it done cheaply, getting it done quickly, getting it done well, right? And that's what the system really is hoping to provide. Just to increase accuracy, efficiency, and consistency. So the overall...
Let me ask a quick question.
Sure.
On the implementation phase, without having us over micromanage, Madam Director, kind of looking through to you, can we get regular updates on this just for 10, 15 minutes during legislative days?
Co-chairs, we would be happy to report back on the status of the project, much like we did with CSR.
Just quick updates on those?
Sure.
John.
I'm sorry, Mr. Co-chair and members of the subcommittee. This project does not have continued funding in 17-19, so that decision still has yet to be
still
made. And just to be clear, the costs of this project have increased significantly, and the timeline has been delayed. The scope has changed, I believe. So significant legislative discussion needs to occur on this particular project in the next month or so. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
I got confused when I saw the bond funding. I thought this was good to go. Okay. Yeah, Representative.
So in terms of the earlier question, though, about vendor selection, are we picking a vendor if we don't have any money in the pipeline?
Co-chairs, Representative Marsh, we have, prior to your sitting on this subcommittee, we have done a lot of conversations with previous Ways and Means and eBoard to talk about the property valuation system. Mm-hmm. And we did get the green light to go ahead with the vendor selection process after reporting to the legislature last year. So we have done that, knowing that we would end up pretty much at that point where they cross, where we have vendor selection and potential legislative approval. If we don't get legislative approval, then we would not sign the contract with the vendor. So the goal was to try to have those converge at the same point in time so that if funding was available, we could sign the contract, and if it's not, we would unfortunately have to let the contract go.
So we don't know how expensive this project's going to be until we hear back on the RFP.
Correct. Co-chairs, we are at the point where we know what the range is. We have currently two vendors, and there is a significant range difference right now. And as Gary said, going through the procurement process, DAS is in control of our procurement process because it is over $150,000, and they are getting us through the legal hoops to give you that final number with the final vendor in this process.
But it would be fair for us to assume it's going to be significantly higher than we had previously discussed.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ballpark?
So ballpark, right now for the software vendor, there are other project costs. So I want to be clear, I'm only talking about the software vendor, is anywhere between 6 and 10 million, 6 to 11 million. And then you still have to look at quality assurance, project management, and
organizational change.
Organizational change.
I think you guys need to get out there and collect some money.
All righty.
Just joking.
It's all good.
Everybody's too serious. Come on.
It's all good.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I would just, Representative Marsh, add to the fact, to your point, our project status by our external QA is currently yellow because of the uncertainty around the budget.
Mm-hmm. All righty. We have about 10 minutes left, or you're wrapped up?
I can be done now.
All right. Thank you. All right. Any other questions from the committee? All righty. Thank you very much. Thanks. We appreciate it. John, anything we need to be thinking about as we wrap up for the day?
No, sir, Mr. Co-Chair.
All right. We're good? Michael? Yeah, I think we have two more days of revenue left. We're good, sir? Good. All right. See, no other issue before us today, folks. We're adjourned.